This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a new 7-month research and reporting project at WNIN, the NPR station in Evansville, about the many ways COVID has had an impact on the Midwest. It's called COVID Between the Coasts, and it's launching as a podcast series today. We'll talk to people who led the project, and later in the show, we'll hear about a piece focused on essential workers. This Wednesday, we'll find out more when we talk to reporters behind an episode on survivor stories, and to the professors who worked with students to interview people and analyze data around the Midwest. And we're joined now by two guests. Sarah Cooper is a reporter and producer at WNIN. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Excited to talk about this.
And Steve Berger is vice president of radio at WNIN. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
So how did this come about, Steve? What was the idea behind this project?
About a year ago, we started working with the University of Evansville to participate in one of their Change Lab classes and for this fall. And when COVID came around and we got to about April, we started talking with the UE professors and said, subject needs to be COVID. And we talked to them extensively because we wanted them to know what they were getting into, because this project is a pretty heavy lift. And they agreed to it. And ever since, they've been working their hearts out. The UE students and professors have just been rock stars on this. So the project was profile the effects of COVID and the impact of COVID and the lived experience of COVID in 7 Midwestern states. Now, those states were chosen because back in April, there was an announcement made that those 7 states were going to participate in ways to recover from the pandemic. Well, that partnership never actually took off, but we already had the 7 states, so we just kept going with that.
We'll dig into a few of the specific episodes in this show and the show we've got coming up on Wednesday. But can you give us a quick rundown of the topics that are covered across the series?
Yeah, survivor stories. And then based on the research that U of E did, we knew that we needed to do deeper dives into the major metropolitan areas in that region. So we picked out Detroit, Minneapolis, and Chicago for specific episodes. And then we do an episode on the research. And Sarah did an episode on the 4 of the states from a more rural perspective. And then we have the U of E students doing one on student athletes. And last but not least, our collaborator in Louisville did a piece on borders, the various borders between states, between countries, and tribal nations, because there are many tribal nations in the Midwest. That was pretty interesting.
Sarah Cooper, how did you and the people leading this decide what to focus on?
Sure. Well, it was, just like COVID, kind of a moving target. I think we started out with the idea of looking at how the first response had gone, lessons learned, and then how, if there was a fall surge, what we would do. But, you know, as history will tell, there was never really a huge first wave in the Midwest, just kind of a plateau. And then it just slowly, as we see now is the big, big spike. So we've had to pivot several times over the summer. The project looked much different than it looks right now. So as we've gone on, it's really been the data where it started, and we were able to narrow down the 3 cities that Steve mentioned, and then also looking at, you know, the rural point of view as well. So it really took time and a lot of being able to adapt, looking into the research, and then also just working with our collaborators on the stories they found. You know, it takes data to kind of whittle things down, but then also seeing the stories on the ground is where we really found sort of those jewels.
Steve, you worked on a piece about Detroit. Can you tell us about that? Why'd you focus on that city?
Well, initially we were looking for ways to include Detroit, but it wasn't happening organically within the other pieces. So I decided to go ahead and head up to Detroit and report. And I was up there for a couple of days, and I had never been in Detroit before. So I just plunged in there and talked to some people and got started. And lo and behold, an amazing story emerges from an area known as District 5 in Detroit. It's one of the civic organizational units in Detroit. And I was able to do a day of reporting in District 5. And it ended up being really interesting because those people had nothing and they got hit so hard early on. They were an epicenter for COVID in the United States, really, back in mid-March into April. And they suffered mightily, but yet they have such a resilience about them, in some cases because of their circumstances. They always have to be very resilient just in their daily lives, but they beat it. If you look at the graph, the dashboard for COVID in Detroit, it looks more like a ski jump hill with a big spike early, and then it went way down and it stayed fairly flat in relation to other cities. So they learned how to do it well, apparently, in Detroit to keep the virus down once they got it beat back. And whereas other cities and states, of course, as we know, they're getting increasing cases as we go into the fall.
Sarah, what's it like doing this remotely? This is a big project.
Sure. Great question. I think all journalists are sort of experiencing that. But it's a little tricky because, you know, I think one thing going into this, we sort of told all our collaborators, do as many sort of video Zoom calls as you can, because there is such a difference between, especially when you're talking about like survivor stories, between hearing someone's voice on the phone and being able to see their face while you're talking with them, because sometimes you can just tell from a look they give you or a pause or just, you know, kind of a turn of their expression, something maybe they're not telling you or something that they stop themselves. So I think that was one technique we figured out. This, a story of this magnitude really needed as much as we could, even though it was remote, to be able to really see each other's faces, to tell these important stories. And some stories you're here, I mean, they're moving, they're really moving stories. So I think as much as possible, we tried to make it personal. There were times, you know, of course, where your only option is on the phone. We have some older people we talk with, but so I think reporting it remotely, it was hard at first because you feel a little disconnected from what's going on. But I think the more research you do and the more you actually speak with people, you're able to kind of get a feel and walk in their shoes.
Finding sources, though, is always a challenge. But, you know, being able, you've been a reporter for a while, being able to go somewhere and talk to somebody face to face does make things easier sometimes and helps narrow things down. How different was this process in this project? What was it like?
Sure. So we used a lot of social media, and we joked early on, we called it stalking, but it's research. It was social media research. And so what we would do is, and we have one collaborator who worked on our survivor stories. She did a lot of this, but she would go into different support group pages, things like that, and look at the comments people had made, not necessarily the people posting, but just to find the people that had something to say, but they weren't quite laying it all out there. So she would reach out to them, you know, and there you would just find this amazing story. I would do things like go online, because I was looking into rural areas. So I would go and look at different church websites and see if they had their online announcements, just to kind of find out, you know, what was going on with people in their own community settings where they were just talking with one another, speaking with, you know, like kindred spirits, you know, and then I would come in and say, hey, why don't you tell me a little bit about that? So I think, you know, it's hard not being able to kind of walk the street and find someone and see what's going on, but social media was a huge tool in helping us find the people with the great stories to tell.
Steve, you worked with a reporter on a piece about the medical supply chain in Minnesota. What'd you find out?
Well, what we found out is that the supply chain is very complicated. In fact, it's so complicated that it's almost indescribably complicated. that was tough trying to narrow that one down. But we found out that most of the PPE, or at least supplies that that manufacturers use to make the PPE in the U.S., like manufacturers like 3M, the supplies actually come from Wuhan, China. So when you have a single source like that for the global supply of that important piece of equipment or the materials to make that equipment, and you have a single source for that, and that source happens to be the epicenter of a global pandemic, it really hurts the supply chain. So what Sarah Lemanchik was the reporter on that, and what she dived into was just how that all works. And then the fact that the state of Minnesota actually has what's known as a government procurement organization, which is one of the middlemen suppliers in the supply in the medical supply chain in the United States. And then she was able to talk to someone from Health and Human Services, the federal agency, to find out that indeed all the talk about the national stockpile, in which you heard, you can remember earlier on some of the comments from the Trump administration that they left the Obama administration left the stockpile bare, is not true at all. But the stockpile was never made for a pandemic. It was made for a singular event such as an anthrax attack or something like that. So but now what we learned is that they are revamping the national stockpile to perhaps be able to participate more in a pandemic type situation. So a lot of important information that will come out of that piece nationally.
Sarah, what do you hope people take away after they listen to the podcast? What do you want people to learn? We've got about 30 seconds, probably not enough time, but what would you like people to know?
Sure. I think it's important to know that there, you know, early on the Midwest did not get a lot of attention for what it was going through with COVID-19, and now it is. But I think that since we have been following it for so long, we just have a great grasp on what these people have been facing during this whole time, whether it's sick with the virus or economically. And so it's I think it will really be eye-opening for a lot of people to hear these stories, not having known what's been going on in the middle of the country this whole time.
We're talking about a new 7-month research and reporting project at WNIN, the NPR station in Evansville, one of our affiliates. It's about the many ways COVID has had an impact on the Midwest. Their podcast series is out as of today. Steve Berger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Cooper, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about a new 7-month research and reporting project at WNIN about COVID's impact on the Midwest. And we're joined by two people behind one part of the podcast series, which comes out today. Judith Ruiz Branch is a reporter at WNIN. Hi, Judith.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Glad you're here. Carly Goldenberg is a contributor at the station who worked on the project as well. Hi, Carly.
Hi, Matt. Thanks so much and happy to be here as well.
Great. Judith, can you tell us how the idea for this piece of the project came about?
Yeah, absolutely. So me and Carly worked together on a series of under WNIN called ¿Qué pasa Midwest? So it's a podcast that's a bilingual podcast that covers the Midwest. And so we had just completed our last season of ¿Qué pasa Midwest? And, you know, sometimes when you are reporting on stories, you often get leads for other stories. And oftentimes it's you don't have the time, you know, to follow after those leads. And so this idea actually came from an interview that I did with an ER doctor in the Chicagoland area, Marina Del Rios, and she's been very active in the local Latino community in terms of COVID education and information and prevention. And so something that she said in one of our interviews that at the time was a little bit off topic, but ended up leading to this project was essential workers. And so it initially started as that, but then to make a long story short, we discovered this mural that was in Pilsen, but we weren't hearing the stories of the actual essential workers that were in the mural. And I thought that was a huge, huge missed opportunity. And that's basically where the idea came from. And I remember texting Carly the day I got the aha moment. And I think any reporter can kind of relate to this when you have that aha moment where you know this is the story and I know it for sure. We both were texting each other and we immediately in that moment said, yes, that's it. That is the story that we need to tell.
Why this specific neighborhood in Chicago? How'd you decide where to focus your reporting?
Well, I think I will leave that up to Carly to discuss because she was really passionate about the Pilsen neighborhood, specifically, well, Little Village and the Pilsen neighborhood. So, yeah, I mean, you can talk about that, Carly.
Yeah, sure, Carly. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, so when we were first starting off our research, like Judith was saying, we knew that we really wanted to speak with essential workers and do sort of a deeper dive beyond beyond typical coverage. And during our conversations, we spoke a lot about how there was a lot of coverage about essential workers and the sorts of jobs that they do or who is an essential worker typically. And in a lot of major metropolitan areas like Chicago, it tends to be people of color, tends to be people who are Black or Latinx. And we took notice of that. But instead of just sort of stopping the story there, I started to look into neighborhoods within Chicagoland that had the highest case rates. And there was a pretty clear delineation from looking at the data that's publicly available that a lot of people along the Southwest side in Chicago were getting COVID, especially earlier on when we first started the reporting. And as a lot of other national news outlets reported, a lot of people in predominantly Latino communities are getting COVID, not because people aren't listening to the guidelines or for any reason like that, but usually because they're more likely to work a job that requires some sort of in-person aspect. And also during the beginning of the pandemic, not everyone that had to come into work for an in-person job was being provided with the necessary medical equipment to protect themselves. So after seeing that and after seeing the pretty clear divide in terms of who within the city of Chicago was getting COVID, we started looking more into communities along the Southwest side, including Gage Park, including Pilsen. And Pilsen is special because, you know, it's a predominantly Mexican-American community. And it's really, like Judith says in the piece, known for its art. So, you know, the fact that a mural was there wasn't necessarily unique, but the fact that, you know, people are being celebrated who are essential workers, and that they are just as worthy of being put on a wall for a mural as anything else was sort of the thing that was special. So similar to with Que Pasa Midwest, where we like to sort of sit with things a little bit longer and dive deeper and always find the people who are most affected, we found that people in this neighborhood were experiencing COVID and were more likely to have someone, whether it was them or their friend, be affected by it. And we wanted to sort of dive deeper and not just end the story there and say, people in Pilsen, in this neighborhood in Chicago, are getting COVID at an increased rate and they're getting sicker from it. But, you know, let's talk to essential workers and let's see, what is your day-to-day experience like? What is your schedule like? And what has your experience under COVID been like? Has anything changed? And I think that Judith did a beautiful job of capturing that and safely getting out there and reporting with a mask and even through plexiglass, even through masks and distance. She was really, I think, able to capture what it's like to be there on the ground and talk to people. And I think that that is part of what makes it so special.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, to piggyback off what Carly said, what was so important with this story is that I think is allowing these essential workers. So they are representatives, right? So they're not all the essential workers, but they do represent a demographic of people who are disproportionately affected by COVID. So I think it was very important to allow them to tell their own narrative, right? And in telling their own narrative, it really turned into a very interesting story, something that you know, as a reporter going into a story, you kind of have in the back of your head what you think or how you think the story might go, right? But then it unfolds very differently. And I think it was so important for us to allow essential workers to tell their own stories, because the media has been telling and constructing that narrative for them for a long time, right? And now it's very important that we hear firsthand from people, representatives of this community, to tell their own stories and their own voices.
Well, before we hear some examples of some of your reporting, I mean, I want to unpack that a little bit more. What do you think of how essential workers have been covered by the media, and how did that then influence your approach to this story?
Yeah, I think that is an excellent question, because unfortunately, I think that, you know, Black and brown people in the media have been kind of depicted as victims, right? And so we allow the media to construct this narrative of Black and brown people. And ultimately, you know, no one stops to even question whether that narrative is correct. And while these numbers are absolutely, you know, accurate, right, and they're absolutely staggering, there is a story behind each of these individuals being affected. And it's important to be able to tell that story from their voices and their narrative, because they tell it in a very different way. They do not look at themselves as victims at all. They look at themselves, you know, as survivors, and as people who literally band together for their families, for their communities, and are grateful to have a job. You know, these are not people who are complaining about having to risk their lives every day. They are grateful that in the midst of a pandemic, they still have a job to go to, and they still have a means to support their family. And so that's a very different narrative than what you see in mainstream media when they're depicted as a victim.
We're talking with Judith Ruse Branch, a reporter at WNIN, and Carly Goldenberg, a contributor at WNIN, who worked on this project on COVID's impact on the Midwest. And so, Carly, can you talk more about who you found to talk to for the story?
Yeah, so actually, Judith found the three people who are depicted in the mural to speak to for this story. So there's Javier, who's a U.S. postal worker. There's Rosalinda, who's a clerk at Los Jasmines. And then there's Juan, who is a butcher shop worker. And the way that she specifically found them is she found the mural, and we both agreed that we thought that this mural and actually seeking out the people within it was something that wasn't a story that had been told yet. And she went into Pilsen and spent time on the ground with them in their stores, at their jobs, and even with the artists at the mural as well, to really get a sense of where does this person work every day? What is it like? What is their environment like? How do they feel? And how do they feel about what's been going on with the pandemic? So I think that that was part of what made it so special. Like Judith was saying, I think that a lot of the coverage has been about the disproportionate impact of COVID on people of color throughout the country. And while that's absolutely true, like Judith said, it's so important to really be with people and spend time with them and get that firsthand account. Because I think that that sort of deficit framing doesn't really leave much space for nuanced conversations. So I think that that was really the key piece. And it was very intentional through multiple conversations with Judith and Steve that it was decided, like, this is the crux of the story, is going out there and speaking to the people in the mural and making sure that it's not just a story about the mural or anything like that, but it's really about, okay, like, these are people who are being honored. And no one has really, from the research we've done, actually spoken with the three people depicted in the mural, and we want to know about them. So that was where the inspiration came from. And it was really kudos to Judith, her reporting on the ground, that allowed us to get those key interviews.
Let's talk first impressions. What were your first impressions of these essential workers when you started talking to them?
So, I mean, I am half Mexican, right? So I'm Latino. So talking to them kind of felt a little bit like home, honestly. And I remember telling my mother, actually, after one of the interviews, the interview that I did with Rosalinda, I said, you know, oh, she reminds me of one of our cousins back home in Mexico. And so to me, you know, it almost felt like I was going back home, you know, or speaking to family members. And so that was my first impression. And I think that really allowed the space for them to feel safe and open up, because it was a risk. I mean, one of the workers that I spoke with is undocumented, right? And normally does not speak to anyone. And the artist told me, you know, he's not going to talk to you. He doesn't like doing interviews because he's undocumented. And so, you know, I listened and I heeded to that, but then something in me told me, just try, you know, and he could say no. And so I did, and he didn't say no. And it was an amazing experience. And you talk about first impressions, but then you talk about what your impression is leaving the interview, right? And I was so inspired by each of them. I can't tell you how inspired I was. And that is why I really wanted their narrative to be told in their voices, and not, you know, I wanted to even step back and say, no, listen to their stories in their voices.
Did anything surprise you, Judith, when you heard from these specific workers?
Yeah, honestly, the hope that they have, it's pretty incredible. And I hope that no pun intended, comes through the story, honestly, because that is the thing that I walked away with that I was most surprised about. Because like you said, you know, we see this depiction in the media, and it doesn't always line up to the actual firsthand stories and firsthand accounts. And so, I walked away very surprised at how hopeful a group of people who, you know, have been disproportionately affected by something so awful as this pandemic that we are living through. They just seem happy, and you will hear them on the tape laughing. You will hear their voices. Their voices are full of joy. Their voices are full of hope. And I don't know why that surprised me. It's unfortunate that that surprised me, but it did surprise me.
Carly, did you get the same kind of feeling, or was anything surprising to you that Judith didn't mention?
I think that I got largely the same feeling as Judith, especially since I got to see the script and then got to sort of listen to the interviews after. I think especially with Rosalinda, who is one of the first people that we hear from in the podcast, that even when she's talking about how long her schedule is, you know, she's working basically every single day from like the early morning until late at night, but she enjoys working in her store, and she really enjoys interacting with people. So it's like, it's this interesting thing where, like, with what Judith was saying, like, when we start to interact with people on that firsthand basis, we leave some room for the possibility that, yes, someone could have experienced COVID and could be experiencing some difficulties at their store potentially from it. But at the same time, they love working at the store. They love interacting with people. And I think that that was a little bit surprising, because I think with most of the national conversation we've been having, where it's mostly based off of data or mostly based off of how people are disproportionately impacted, sometimes these kinds of nuances, I don't think, come through. But I think that that was what surprised me, that there still is so much joy and so much laughter and so much perseverance. You know, there are people that Judith spoke to that are experiencing a lot of pressure right now, and that are still in the wake of a national pandemic and, you know, huge economic crashes, are still supporting their families and still coming to work every single day, and finding purpose in that. So I think that that's something really special that I wouldn't necessarily have expected based on any of the other pieces that I've been reading or any of the other conversations that I'd really heard about up until that point. So I think that that's really special.
Yeah. And sorry, just to jump in. Yeah. But it reminds me of when I talked to Juan, the butcher shop worker, and he was the last essential worker in the mural that I interviewed. And he is 25, so he's so young, and he's already been through so much in his life. He came over to the United States from Guatemala with his brother to find work when he was a teenager. I think I just said that, sorry. And and it's, his story is just, he's been through so much. And not only that, right, just to kind of have to adjust to a new culture, right, a new way of living and a new society and community. Not only that, but he's undocumented. He doesn't have health insurance. And so the risk of contracting COVID is especially fearful. He's especially fearful of that. And he is, along with his brother and other siblings that came to the United States, are supporting his parents back home in Guatemala because his father isn't able to work due to health issues. And so, you know, you have this immense pressure, you know, on these individuals. But when you speak to them, when you look at them in their eyes, when you interact with them, when you hear their stories and when they talk to you, you don't sense any of that. You sense gratefulness, you sense joy, you sense hope. And like she said, perseverance, like Carly said, perseverance and resilience, right? And so that I think is so important to be able to include those nuances because that's the real story.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking to WNIN reporters behind a story about essential workers, part of a new project from the station about COVID's impact on the Midwest. Their podcast series is out today. We're back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on essential workers impacted by the pandemic. And we're talking to reporters behind a story that's one part of a new 7-month research and reporting project at WNIN, the NPR station in Evansville, about the many ways COVID has had an impact on the Midwest. Their podcast series is out today. We're talking with Judith Ruiz Branch, a reporter at WNIN, and Carly Goldenberg, a contributor there who worked on this project. And Carly, what kind of financial support do these workers have, the ones that you talked to? You mentioned, or it was mentioned rather, that some of them are undocumented. Are they eligible for any kind of outside support?
Right. So this didn't end up necessarily serving a super big part of the story, but I did speak to a few grassroots organizations, and that was a really big gap that that they identified. So similar to what Judith was saying, someone who's undocumented is not really eligible for health insurance. And similarly, someone who's undocumented is also not eligible for aid from the federal government when an outbreak of a pandemic of this size happens and the United States decides, okay, everyone who, you know, is a taxpayer and of a certain age and is an independent person is going to get a check from the government. Undocumented people do not receive those checks. And so that is a really big concern, especially in Chicago. And a lot of people express concern for not only their ability to just keep going, but also to pay rent. And as a result of that, several grassroots organizations along the Southwest side in Chicago did work together with nonprofits and try to raise money through a GoFundMe. And they were able to, like, for example, I know that the Gage Park Latinx Council did that, and they were successful. They were able to distribute those funds throughout the community. And the specific intention of this GoFundMe was to create sort of like a replacement for the federal check that most people would have gotten, but for undocumented community members. And that was the specific intent of it. And I think that that's a really good example of community members on the ground in Chicago recognizing, you know, as soon as word of this stimulus got out, that we know realistically not everyone in our community will receive that. So what are we going to do? And coming together and trying to figure out a solution. And I think that even just with something like a GoFundMe, where it could seem pretty simple from the outside, from the inside, the organizers of the GoFundMe and other similar efforts have to be very careful and reassure people, even in the description of it, you know, we're not going to collect your information. We're not going to give your information to the government. We're not going to ask you for your address or for other personal information. And no one else is going to have access to this, because even when people really do need that money or could benefit from that money, there's a really big fear of, if there's a trace of me somewhere, then I could potentially have ramifications. And I think that that's a really real fear. And I think that it's similar to the fear that Judith talked about, where people who are undocumented and do not have access to health insurance are scared, just like everyone else is, of getting COVID in the first place. But then there's all these additional questions of, if I do get sick with COVID, where can I go? Because if I go to a hospital or something like that, there is the idea of patient-client confidentiality. But what if I say I'm undocumented to the doctor and they, you know, they call the police or something? So I think that it is worth noting that even during a pandemic, when we have people who are living basically paycheck to paycheck, we have people who might not be employed, who were previously employed, that specifically undocumented community members were not eligible for even the stimulus check, and that that could really affect people.
Yeah. And in the story, though, Matt, there is a small piece when I'm speaking with Rosalinda about the fact that she didn't qualify, her or her husband, basically her household didn't qualify to receive any aid from the government, any stimulus check, because her husband is still in the process of becoming a resident. And so while, yeah, like Carly said, it wasn't, you know, a prominent topic in the story, it is in there subtly. And additionally, while she was out of work, Rosalinda and her husband were out of work for over a month to ensure her safety and the safety of others, right? Because she works with the public every single day, and so does her husband. They contracted COVID at the very beginning. So it was in April. And at that time, resources were not as abundant as they are now in her community. And so her and her husband had to pay to get tested $100 each, so $200 in total. So on top of being out of work and not qualifying for aid and losing that money, and you don't have, you know, you don't have medical leave. It's not like they were taking medical leave. It was, they were out of work and they lost the money that they would normally make within a month's time. And now you have an extra expense, which should have never happened in the first place. So it's really interesting that you bring up that topic.
Judith, while I have you, we heard from some essential workers on our show early on in the pandemic, and they seemed both worried and, as you've mentioned already, extremely resilient when they're asked about the health risks involved in going to work. There was this sense that this was inevitable, that they had to go to work. So that was that. What did you hear from these workers on that front?
Exactly what you just described, Matt. I mean, I think that the risk of contracting COVID for them is just like the risk of maybe getting hit by a car crossing the street. It's just something, it's another added risk that they have to, you know, encounter every day as they go to work, as they, you know, try to support their families. And this is not something that they can necessarily avoid. And so I think that I mentioned that in the piece, and it's very important to, for people to realize that, that this is not, you know, as we approach another stay at home order, at least here in Illinois and Chicago, you know, some people cannot do that. They just can't. And so this is just another, it's just another thing that they have to deal with day in and day out. And that's exactly how they're facing it. They're not looking at it like, wow, this is going to stop me from working. They're looking at it like, okay, this is a risk, but it's a risk that I have to take.
Carly, did you get any sense for how safe the work environments are right now for these workers and others like them?
I get the sense that from a conversation I had with someone at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, that it's still definitely not safe. And anyone who is an essential worker and has an in-person job is drastically more likely to have COVID or to have a coworker have it. but that things are slowly but surely starting to improve by maybe the smallest amount. One of the things that I was told is that during the beginning of the pandemic, in addition to the fact that everyone was working in person and that just really ramps up the risk of getting COVID, that so many people, because the change happened so quickly, just didn't have access to, you know, we have some people who have access to things like N95 masks and expensive hand sanitizer, things like that. But a lot of, you know, the average person didn't, and the average essential worker definitely didn't either. So I think that things are still extremely risky, unfortunately, but maybe in terms of access to things like masks or resources that were a little bit scarce before, that things are getting a little bit easier on that front. But I think certainly, you know, health officials predicted that during the winter we would have another surge. And so I think that we really need to be vigilant and to look out for essential workers in our communities, because as the winter gets colder and colder, especially in places like Chicago and other places throughout the Midwest, more and more people will be congregating inside. And so I think that that's another factor that is kind of in the background too.
Judith, I want to talk about the essential worker you spoke to who got COVID. What did she tell you?
Rosalinda, yeah. It was interesting because I must have been talking to her for about 6 minutes. And so, you know, it doesn't seem like a really long time, but it is when you're speaking to someone who, you know, you don't know. And she said, you know, I'm going to tell you something. You know, she just blurted it out. I'm going to tell you something. And she said this in Spanish. I got COVID. I got COVID at the beginning of the pandemic. And I was like, wow. You know, I felt really honored that she would feel safe enough to share that with me. And fortunately for her, very, very fortunately, she didn't experience complications. She said she felt that she had a cold or a flu, cough, you know, runny nose, but she felt mostly fine, and so did her husband. And they were able to stay home, and they didn't ever have to leave the house or go to the hospital for an emergency situation. Their health never escalated in that way, so that was very fortunate for them. I think what affected her the most, and she says that in the piece, and I included it, is that missing work for her, right? And so it's interesting the perspective of somebody like an essential worker who has to work, who cannot take off work because you cannot take a sick day. You're not going to get paid that day, right? You're not going to get paid for the days that you don't work. And so the perspective is very different. And I think that, you know, I don't have medical science to back this up, but that kind of spirit of resilience and hope really, I think, helps them in the long run when you are facing a virus and a pandemic like COVID. And so I was very, I felt very honored that she would share that with me.
Is more reporting, Judith, on essential workers, is there more that needs to be done? Do you think, I mean, whether your team at WNIN is able to do it or not, I mean, are there still significant gaps on reporting on the issue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you see all of these murals going up in the Chicago area, right? Pilsen is not the only area that has dedicated works of art to essential workers. And that is amazing, right? So you're seeing them in urban areas, and they are bringing attention to a much needed demographic and community. And I respect that, and I am so grateful for that. But we are still missing the key component, which is, who are these people? We're seeing their faces, but we're not hearing their stories. And so I definitely think that there is still a huge gap, because we have only spoken to three, right? And these are representative, but they don't cover the entire community or demographic of community workers. So absolutely, absolutely. I think any outlet and any reporter that can get firsthand accounts of essential workers, do it, because we need to hear those stories.
I asked you about financial support earlier, Carly. What about emotional support? How crucial have family and community been for these essential workers and helping them get through this?
I think that family and community play such an essential role. One of the people who got COVID, for example, that was interviewed by Judith, was, you know, like Judith said, staying at home is such a privilege, and it's unfortunately a privilege that isn't afforded by many people. So when people get sick and they need to stay home, having members of your community or having a family member like your brother come and bring you food and drop it off at your door so that you can be sustained is essential. And I think too that in a similar way to a family member coming and bringing you food because you're sick and you can't go anywhere and you need to stay inside, community organizations are really bridging this gap where, you know, you have groups of people where they don't have the best experiences with local government, and they don't really trust local government, especially if they're in a vulnerable position, like they're an undocumented community member, or they're in a mixed status family where maybe some people have certain privileges and certain people don't. So what I've really seen, especially in Chicago, is that grassroots organizations and trusted community members are playing the role of bridging people together, and they are allowing people to get access to information and resources in a way that feels safe for people, and people feel like they can trust them. So I think that undoubtedly, you know, without community members, that a lot more people wouldn't have access to care. For example, all the way back in April, when there was sort of like an environmental disaster that happened in a predominantly Latino neighborhood in Chicago, because a company decided to destroy a coal turbine and it filled the air with dust on like Easter weekend. Who were the people that were going and knocking on doors? They were environmental justice groups from the local community. They were local community members, and they were the people who were going and visiting neighbors and saying, how are you doing? Do you have any needs? You know, and that's how we found out a lot of about a lot of problems, like I guess topics like food insecurity during COVID or other issues that weren't just the literal health pandemic aspect of it were only really brought to light by community members. And like we talked about with funding, I think that community organizations have played such a huge role in not only financial, but emotional support and ensuring that community members, especially from places in Chicago that might not be as well understood or have as many reporters in them, still have their needs advocated for in a way that they're comfortable with.
Yeah, and I think that takes us back to, Matt, one of the questions you asked us in the very beginning about why Pilsen? Why is Pilsen so special? And I think this speaks directly to that. Pilsen is so special because it's one of those neighborhoods in Chicago that has cultivated that sense of community where if you don't have family here, or if you came to this country and most of your family is not here with you, you have a community surrounding you. And I think while this is not a main topic of the story, it did come up, the issue of gentrification and how that's affected stores like Los Jasmines and workers like Rosalinda, and how they've had to kind of react to it and re-strategize because the community that they originally opened their business in and the community that they live in and have grown up in or have lived in since they came to this country is changing now, right? So you're changing kind of the structure of that community feel, of that family feel. And it's a huge issue that is continuing throughout Chicago. And I think that that sense of community and that sense of family is essential when you are when you're facing something like COVID.
The podcast project is called COVID Between the Coasts, and it has been compiled by WNIN. And we have been talking with Judith Ruiz Branch, a reporter there. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Judith.
No, thank you, Matt.
Carly Goldenberg is a contributor there at WNIN who worked on the project as well. Carly, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation on Indiana's show caves. Find more on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.